of private post-secondary education is called to order at 10 a.m. All board members and staff, please introduce yourselves.
Kevin LaMountain, State Board Staff.
Mike Romano, Board.
Craig Jacob, Board.
Rachel Pierce, Administrative Assistant.
Chris Leonard, Board.
Dick Lutke, Board.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, Board.
Bill Vance Wall, Board.
Terry Stanfield, Executive Director.
If everyone in the audience and board members for that matter, make sure your cell phone is silenced. Unlike our old building, we actually have reception in here. We may break for lunch at 12:30, so that's an incentive for all of you to move it along so you don't have to stay any later. The board, upon a majority vote of the quorum of the members, may go into executive session for the purpose of obtaining legal advice pursuant to ARS 48431-03A3. Any not on the agenda. The board, upon a majority vote of the quorum of the members, may also go into executive session to discuss or consider records exempt from law for public inspection, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is specifically required to be maintained as confidential by state or federal law pursuant to ARS 38431-03A2. The board reserves the right to change the order of the agenda items with the exception of hearings. Ms. Stanfield, are there any requests to change the order of the agenda?
Yes, Madam Chair, if we could please move Ottawa to be first and then UTI and MMI to be second.
All right. First order of business is acceptance of the April 26, 2018 audio recording as the official minutes of the board meeting. The meeting minutes have been posted on the website and is the official record of the meeting. Ms. Stanfield, have you confirmed that minutes are posted and are audible?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions? All right. If not, may I have a motion to approve the audio recording?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and second. Any discussion? We are accepted. All those in favor say aye. we have to do as a roll call.
Madam Chair, we need to start doing the roll call vote.
So roll call.
Mike Romano, yay.
Craig Jacob, yay.
Chris Leonard, yay.
Dick Lutke, yay.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, yay.
Bill Vance Wolf, yay.
All right. The says action only for April 26th executive session meeting minutes. We need to do a
call. Just a motion to approve and then a roll call.
All right. Do you have a motion?
So moved.
And second?
Second.
So motion and second. No discussion? All those in favor, by roll call.
Mike Romano, yay.
Craig Jacob, yay.
Chris Leonard, yay.
Luke, yay.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, yay.
Bill Vance Wall, yay.
They are accepted.
Just because this is an audio recorded meeting, motions in a second, but 8 minutes.
All right, the first item on the agenda will be the discussion and action of the 2018 license renewal for Ottawa University. Both the Phoenix and Surprise campuses. Ms. Stanfield.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. During staff review of the 2018 license renewal applications for both the Phoenix and Surprise campuses of Ottawa, staff had concerns regarding the two-year financial losses of the parent company. It should be noted that the Arizona campuses are profitable. The main campus for Ottawa is in Ottawa, Kansas, and Ottawa has been licensed by the board since 1985. Here representing the institution is Mr. Tom Corley, Director of Business Operations, and Clark Rabordi. Did I close? Okay. And your board member lead is Dr. Leck and Mr. Van Zyl.
Anyone representing the school would like to come forward and have a seat? And then introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Clark Riberty. I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer for Ottawa University.
I'm Tom Corley, Director of Business Operations for Ottawa University.
Welcome.
Good morning. Welcome. Would you like to make an opening statement?
Sure. Be happy to. As it's been noted by the board, Ottawa University as a whole, the consolidated financial statement and position For the last 2 years, we have posted operating losses. 2 years ago, approximately $1.8 million. Last year, approximately $558,000. Those are the reported results. The two campuses in Arizona, Phoenix and in Surprise, are both, as were mentioned, profitable. And I will also add that for the year that will end, basically 40 days, 35 days, June 30 of 2018, not only will those campuses in Arizona be profitable, but the university as a whole will also post profit. So I'll start there, and more than happy to entertain any questions the board may have. And thank you for having me.
I'd like to start off with your accreditation information, the history of it. And the reason being is that it looks as if for the last 8 years, you guys have been on financial reporting to the Higher Learning Commission. And so is this the,
don't believe so.
Okay, so according to the SAS online, you guys had monitoring financial indicator in 2017. Financial panel recommended an interim report in 2012. In 2011, they added progress report on financial concerns, and in 2010, added progress report on finances.
They reviewed us in 2009, and they asked for a statement of financial plan, recovery plan, which we issued, and then they approved that in. I may get my years wrong. I apologize. 2010, 2011. And then we had our 10-year review, which I believe was in the full visit HLC. And I'm not the assessment person, so I apologize. I probably get some of the words wrong. But in 2014, I believe. Is that correct? And then we had the 10-year. And then they came out this past fall to do their first interim visit post that 10-year visit. And their one action item was that they had asked that we give them a financial plan in December of 2018, which we will provide.
So it's just the history. I'm just asking about the history because it's
sure.
Talk about the last 2 years. I'm assuming that it was occurring prior to that as well, the financials of the university needing to be reviewed.
From in 2009, they reviewed and we provided that, and then we posted surpluses in years subsequent to that. And then, as you mentioned, in the past 2 years, we've had losses.
One of the things that it says that you guys took action on was reducing your staffing.
We did.
Did that include faculty?
I won't remember all the different positions. Certainly, if there were faculty that we felt met the criteria, they would have been. I don't recall any faculty. I think it was predominantly staff.
What was the criteria?
Varied by class. Most of it was based on seniority. It was a reduction in force. In 2 different years, we had reductions in force. It dropped the operating expenses of the university approximately $6.3 million.
Out of curiosity, did that increase any student complaints for lack of service or the unit adequate staff to cover?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Great.
No. Now, I want to be sure everyone understands that reduction in expense is somewhat masked by the fact that we were also launching the campus initiative in Surprise. So while we were reducing expenses in these areas of the organization, we were launching the Surprise campus. Therefore, there were operating costs that were increasing at the same time. So when you look at those operating costs, the total financials, which are issued on a consolidated basis, you won't see a $6 million drop in that expense line because at the time we were reducing some necessary costs on these in these departments, in these areas, we were bringing that campus in Surprise online. So, poor choice of words, we were launching that campus in Surprise.
So the campus in Surprise is now open.
Yes, ma'am.
On the application, I was just unclear. It lists 14 faculty and 4 staff at both the Phoenix campus and the Surprise campus. And I guess I was assuming, since at least I understood the Surprise campus to be a residential campus, those aren't the same people, are they, or are they?
I don't know the answer.
No, that was because we hadn't opened the campus at the time we did the reporting. We now have a staffing that, since they opened in fall, this year, that did not include those. We've actually hired staff to handle our residential campus.
Okay. So then one other question I had was when it looked at your percentage of your retention rate at Surprise in the application for ending 6/30/17, it noted a retention rate of 0.22, but I was unclear if it had, in one point, it said zero students, and I might be losing my mind here.
The campus for Surprise opened in the fall of 2017?
Yeah, so on the application, it says that there was total number of current students as of 7/1/16 had 18 people. But it didn't open yet, so I wasn't sure how we...
We were
operating in an adult branch campus in that very location.
Oh, okay.
And that was that community that Maricopa Community College System had. We were one of their four-year tenants. And so we've been operating there, teaching adult students since 2009. And then we have now taken over that entire building. And we don't offer the adult courses there now. We're now offering the traditional student, the four-year degree.
Got it. That helps explain that. Thank you. What was your fall 17 enrollment? Fall 17.
For Surprise?
Yeah.
434 students on a budget of 380.
Okay. That was a nice surprise.
Pun intended, I assume. Yes, it was a nice surprise.
So I also noted that your default rate is kind of heading up. It's grown a little bit. At least the 2014 reported was 8.7, whereas the year before that was 6.9. Do you know what you would attribute that to?
A lot of that has to do with the fact that we, you know, more students are taking out aid to enroll in schools, and we've just had some losses compared, you know, where they don't either continue, and so they're not paying back their financial aid as they don't continue with us, and we've seen an uptick in that because of those reasons. More students using financial aid to enroll, and the fact that we've also had more students leave the university after taking financial aid, and it's very hard to collect those dollars.
Yeah, so the retention rate, even on the 18 students with a 22% retention rate, is not good.
Part of that was because those students, you know, we were no longer holding the classes out there, and I would assume that they decided not to continue because of where they would have to either drive to come to school, because we had our Phoenix campus and we held classes out at Queen Creek.
Well, that was specific to Surprise, though. So it said you had 18 students, but you continued to teach the adult learners at that location, right? Because even on the application, it shows you have some master's programs that are approved for Surprise. So I guess I'm assuming you do adults there as well as residential.
Those are for our GAs that we have. We have hired GAs to help handle things, and as part of their benefit, they're enrolled in our master's courses. That's why they're not adults. There are 30 plus GAs that are part of our athletic program and other areas that are taking the master's classes.
And are they're taking them physically there or online?
Most of them are probably taking it online, or they come to our Phoenix campus to take it.
Anyone else have any other questions? Would you like to go?
Sure. So I'd like to review your financial statements with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at your audited financial statements, and so for the last couple of years, you've had declines in your cash. So I'm looking at the statement of cash flows here. Pretty significant from operating activities. You have negative cash flow from operating activities, which can't, you know, that's a giveaway you've got financial problems. You don't make money off of what you do for a living. So it looks like you're saying you're going to turn the cash flow statement around this year. And I'm looking at the projections that you provided to us for five-year projections. for 2017 to 2018, and you were projecting like $50 million in revenue versus $35 million in revenue for 2017. So is that, are you on track for that? Or
absolutely. Yeah, the opening of the Surprise Campus, substantial increase in revenue.
Okay, so that's really the difference between last year and this year is the Surprise Campus?
From an operations perspective, yes. Okay.
And so are you projecting you're going to have positive cash flow from operating activities this year?
Yes, sir.
So because you can't, you can operate for a long time if you're having a financial economic net loss, but you can't operate for very long if you don't have cash flow. So.
Could not agree with you more.
So, you know, it's all, to me, it's always about the cash flow. Right?
Yes, sir.
If you can't turn that around, you're not going to be here. So, all right. So, to summarize, you are on track because of the Surprise Campus opening. You're on track to meet your projections or come close to your projections and have a positive cash flow this year.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Just a follow-up question. So the Surprise Campus is providing an extra $15 million of revenue in this coming year?
Approximately. I'd have to go look at the numbers. I'm more than happy to do that.
That's a lot. And that's projected based on what enrollment?
We opened with 434, as I mentioned, and our fall to spring retention was overall was very high. We had 400 students in the spring term, and we are budgeting 608 students for this fall term that will start in August. The operators are saying that we will be substantially over that, maybe as high as 630, but we aren't counting on that. So that's where that additional revenue and cash flow is coming.
So that's a sizable bump from 400 to 600, but it comes midway in your fiscal year.
Well, it'll be for the fall of 2018, so that will be our first major term in our fiscal year of 18-19. We'll have the summer term. We have summer classes for both the adult students and the two residential campuses.
How many of your students, so 434 were in the fall, how many of those reside on campus? Because even though your residential campus, not, you know, you usually have commuters.
Correct. We do not have student housing on campus built at this time, but we went and secured alternate housing for them in local hotels. And I will, again, I don't have those numbers in front of me, so pardon me if I'm a little bit off, but I think we housed about 180, maybe 200 students in university secured housing. We didn't own that. Those were local hotels and apartments. And we will secure the same type of arrangement for this coming fall. And we have the first housing unit is now underway, as well as the athletic facility.
So having experience with residential students, how are you, I'm curious, how are you monitoring these students if they're living in a hotel?
They have an RA. They have an RA just like a dormitory.
So you booked out like a floor or something in a hotel?
Yes, we're taking a wing.
Students?
Yeah, we're taking a whole wing. And we, I don't know how far in the minutiae you want to get, but we basically removed the hotel room furniture at our cost and stored it, and then put in more traditional furnishings that you'd see in a student room. So the smaller beds, the bureaus, the desks, and those types of things. And then one of those rooms is equipped for an RA.
Right, so you're trying to do about 50% residential?
We anticipated it being higher. But it was a little bit of an interesting phenomenon to us that many of the students did not want housing. A lot of them were local in our first year, so they were more Phoenix metro area students, so they wanted to live at home. So we didn't really have a large unmet demand for those housed students. We anticipate that this fall it might be a little bit more of a challenge, but so we're reaching out. The market in Surprise, as I'm sure you guys are aware, is pretty hot, and they're building, and there are so many apartment complexes in that mile radius of that civic complex, and those developers are more than happy to speak with us about leasing a block of units, especially on a short-term basis, because they can't get them leased up immediately like we can when we walk in and take 20 units off their hands, but yet they really don't want to do that with students for 5 years, right? So we're able to walk in and say, well, we'll have our residential complex built in the fall of 19, so we only need them for a year, so they can get all that income right up front, which helps them out as a developer, but yet then in a year they know they can turn around and have their complex filled with perhaps non-students, which some of them think that may not be the best thing to offer for their for the neighbors. So we understand that. So if that makes any sense.
So you're charging the students to room and board?
Correct.
Which goes to the finances, which is where I'm at. So like in a hotel, how does that work? Are they able to get, are you giving them a better rate than they could get at the hotel? Like how?
Oh, absolutely. The hotels that we were using, the hotel that we used, they were very interested in partnering with us because we provided them with a revenue stream for the entire year where their typical occupancy in the less cool months in this climate, they were in the 20% range. And so we took a book of rooms, 47 rooms, I think, and leased them for the entire year. And our rate was $15 per student per night is what we paid the hotel. And they were more than happy to have that revenue stream.
Any questions?
What do you see the capacity of the Surprise Campus?
Very good question. Thank you. It will. We believe that we will house over 1,000 students in the next, not house, I'm sorry, we will service 1,000 students in the next 3 to 4 years. Our first housing unit, which will come online in fall of 2019, will be around 300 beds. We believe that we will be under construction for the next 300-bed sister building concurrently with as we finish up the first one. And then the third one will come online shortly after that. So we will be in construction over the next 3 years, building 300 beds, 300 beds, 300 beds, maybe 333 to get to that 1,000 number. But that's what we believe. We believe 3,000 students in 10 years.
Are you seeing from the programs that you have offered, like 30-plus at the Surprise that you have listed, are you seeing any weightedness over to a particular group right now? Or is that?
Not right now. I need to be careful because the first 434 students, the large, most of those students were the athletes, so they tend to move towards certain programs. As we begin to, and now we are offering additional athletic programs for this coming term, so there will be another 100 roughly students that will come just simply for the athletic programs. But then there are other students that are being recruited, of course, they were and they will be, that are the non-student athletes, and their interests tend to move in a different direction in many cases. So haven't really seen any weighting towards one or the other.
How do you anticipate working through the employment side of supporting the employment post-graduation for students, for the students of assisting them with jobs?
Oh, we have departments that handle all the career service elements of that. I don't really get involved with that, but we certainly do have that, and we will offer as much support as we can. I'm sorry, that's not my department, but I'm more than happy to get as much information as I can for you.
So the students that you're anticipating there are more the traditional college age?
Correct.
Do you think that the students who currently do in-seat classes at the Phoenix campus, do you think that, not the online students, but the ones who, I assume you still offer classes at your...
Yes.
In Phoenix for adult students, yes.
Some of them may be coming farther from the West Valley, so with that campus opening up, do you think that's going to reduce headcount at Phoenix campus that maybe you're anticipating staying the same in Phoenix, but some will be drawn to that Surprise campus?
I would say more of the latter, but I think what would happen is, certainly if a student resides in the West Valley and is currently driving to Phoenix to attend an adult campus in Phoenix, my assumption would be that they would stop doing that if we offer that same program in Surprise. I don't know the demographics of all the students that currently attend Phoenix. I do know that our Phoenix campus is thriving. I think it will continue to thrive. And we certainly hope to begin offering adult courses in the Surprise campus as well, as we did.
Oh, you mean more like in the evening?
Yeah, the evening course, yes. Thank you.
So currently you're not offering evening?
No, we are not offering.
No, them. We do not have any adults attending.
I've just seen sometimes when people open up a campus, they assume that, you know, it's doing its own draw, and they don't think about the fact that it's drawing from somewhere else.
We have deliberately thought about that, and we didn't see a lot of movement back to Phoenix when we stopped offering adult courses in Surprise. I don't think we did.
No.
So it just depends on where those students are residing or working, right?
I mean, potential market then, that if you offer the classes at night in Surprise, that may actually help you.
I think it could help.
Since there could be people out there who aren't willing to drive.
Correct. I think it could help. And you guys know the adult. I mean, they're... If the campus where they want to take classes is close to work or close to home, though, that's where they'll go. So.
Well, on that note, are you utilizing all these branch campuses and cohort sites you have listed?
A lot of those sites are in there because of our continuing education for what we call our professional education, and that's where they teach. You know, teachers come back and take classes to keep up their certifications. So most of those auxiliary locations have been for those programs. Rather than the traditional degree programs. We have to have those because it helps to get into the schools and things like that where we can teach right there.
Right.
I didn't understand what the difference between your definition of auxiliary classrooms and cohort sites was. What's the definition between those two?
The cohort site is where you take a group from the same school usually and you teach them at that site, where the auxiliary could draw from anywhere in close proximity, but the cohorts, I don't believe they do that as much as they had in the past, and part of that's because of how the continuing education has occurred here in the Valley for the teachers. You know, a lot of schools now are doing it in-house versus us going out and teaching.
Right. Any other questions? Are you interested in making a motion?
I would like to make a motion. Fine. So I would like to make a motion to approve the license renewals for Ottawa University with the stipulation that a surety bond in the amount of $330,526 be posted, and that they provide copies of electronic student records on a monthly basis.
Do you agree to that?
Yes.
Do you have a second?
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Mike Romano, aye.
Greg Jacob, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Dick Lupke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Vance Wool, aye.
All right, most passes. Good luck.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Madam Chair, I'm going to recuse myself.
Mike Romano has recused himself for the next case. The next order of business is the 2018 license renewals for the regular degree granting license renewal for Universal Technical Institute, UTI, and regular vocational program license renewal for our Motorcycle Mechanics Institute, MMI. Can you please introduce yourselves?
Absolutely. My name is Scott Yesner. I'm the Interim Chief Financial Officer for Universal Technical Institute.
Good morning. I'm Kimberly Brockman, Regional Compliance Analyst.
And I'd also like to introduce two additional colleagues that are here to support the discussion today. Lori Smith, who heads up our Compliance and Business Intelligence Group, and then Justin Call, who heads up our SEC Reporting and Financial Reporting.
Why don't you go ahead and pull chairs up here, that way if you speak, you can just grab a chair from the corner there.
Great. I have some open remarks, and then very excited to answer any questions that this group has. I'd like to first start, I'm very grateful to have an opportunity to present on behalf of Universal Technical Institute today. This organization has a longstanding relationship with the state of Arizona. And it's a very important relationship to us, and I am very interested in how we can help support this relationship. So starting with the introduction, like I indicated before, I am the Interim Chief Financial Officer for Universal Technical Institute. I come to the organization via Tatum Partners. I am a Chief Financial Officer consultant with that firm. So I'm at this time a consultant. I have a consulting relationship with Universal Technical Institute. This engagement was brought on by the need for the complexity in the business. It is not a reflection of any concerns that they had with their financial reporting or business matters. As I go through my opening remarks and describe the change in the complexity of our business and the sophistication of which we're operating at, it was determined that they were seeking a different chief financial officer to support this business. There is a permanent CFO search underway, and I am a candidate in that search. So, as we go through this process here, I would like to talk about our core business fundamentals and then progress over the last couple of years with our performance, our strategy, and then conclude with some risk management remarks and then open it up for questions. And so starting with our core fundamentals of UTI, what we believe we have is a very valuable service that we can provide students in a marketplace that has a high demand for our students. Our business challenge is that the nature of the students and how we can serve them best is challenged by our footprint. Many years ago, it was much easier to have students come to our destination campuses. This was identified many years ago by UTI as a challenge as that progressed into individuals less likely to commute, and that commuter campus structures were a preferred mechanism long term. With that, over the last few years, the organization has invested in and repurposed its footprint. We have opened up two commuter campuses, and when we say commuter, those are smaller campus size, smaller risk to the overall organization for overcapacity, and a better experience for our students who prefer to have a local destination rather than having to move to one of our schools. We are in the process of opening our third metro campuses. Our first two campuses, metro campuses Long Beach and Dallas-Fort Worth, have been very successful both in our students that we have in those locations and the earnings margins on those businesses. So we're very excited about Bloomfield. In addition to rationalizing our footprint and our overcapacity at our destinations, we've also looked at adding additional programs into some of our locations, and those include CNC and welding. And then further to that extent, we are in the process and will continue to save money and resources as we sublease portions of our business. So those are the fundamentals of our business, and I want to take you through the last couple of years and talk about our financial performance and our strategies around it and how we're managing the risks associated with it. And so as we go into 2017, UTI experienced just about a $2 million loss, GAAP earnings loss, but we did earn about $18 million in EBITDA. So our business was generating cash flow, our operating business, but our overall footprint was generating a loss. That year, we did a substantial expense reduction. We saved almost $40 million. However, it wasn't enough. We did have a decline in revenue of over $20 million, which led to the $2 million loss. We were also still in the process of investing into our metro campus footprints. You know, at that time, we also looked at other ways to invest into our business, and that came in a number of different dimensions. I believe it was brought up in last year's hearing, but I'll remind the board. In 2016, we brought on a new capital partner that made a $70 million investment into UTI. as we moved into 2017, and the new capital partner was assisting the firm in helping us analyze our business and grow profitably, there was additional changes. So to support our infrastructure, a new chairman was brought on, and that freed up our CEO from the responsibilities of being the chairman and CEO to focusing on the business. In addition to that, a new chief operating officer was brought on to help assist in operating the business and bringing new ideas to this infrastructure. In the fall of 2017, with that loss, the company went through an analytical process to look at its strategic options. And so those really come into three different areas. We could have looked at M&A opportunities to expand our metro campus footprint. We could have looked at organic opportunities to expand our metro campus footprint. Or we can analyze our core business to determine if there are ways to make it more profitable. And so effectively, we cut a lot of cost out of our corporate and overhead, but we hadn't gone through the process yet with our sales, marketing, and missions. And so in the fall, there was an analytical process supported by consultants, outside consultants to the firm, to evaluate, you know, if we should be looking at sales and marketing and other opportunities to better serve our students and to create a more profitable business. The conclusion, after considering those three options and the feedback from the analysis from the consultants, was we do have an opportunity to improve our sales, marketing, and admissions process to help support the students and to make a more profitable business. Further to that point, being more effective in these core mechanisms to the business are very scalable. And so as we look at our metro campus expansion and reorganizing our footprint, all the benefits that we do at getting better at serving students and being better at our marketing, sales, and admissions process support this expansion. So the conclusion was that the board approved, with the support of our investors, a substantial investment in our analysis and change of our sales, administration, and marketing businesses. That final decision and conclusion.
What does that entail?
Yep, and that's the next one I was going into. Great. And so what that entailed is in earlier this year, McKinsey, who was doing the initial analysis, they went into a full engagement with us, which we have announced publicly, to support us and guide us and lead us through a transformational process. And there's four core main areas to that. It's our marketing. We're in the analytical process. Our marketing channels weren't very efficient, and there were opportunities to be more efficient. In our admissions process, there were inefficiencies in that admissions and sales process in assisting students in getting through our funnel. So we were a little bit more challenging to do business with. A lot of this came from the headwinds as the company was reacting to headwinds and cutting costs. And we sort of fell behind in our customer service and our customer experience. And then supporting students who are making a challenging decision that's a good career decision for them, but a challenging decision. So we noticed that in the analytical process, they came through and said that there's different areas where your students are falling off that you can support them with. And so we have tactics around that process to getting to show after they've committed. And then in the completion process, there was other initiatives that were determined that can help support a student while they're going through the process of the education. And so the result of that was we have over 50 separate initiatives, so we don't have, you know, one or two different things that have to succeed. It's a variety of different initiatives. We have McKinsey on site. We've disclosed in our SEC reporting and announced their relationship with us. So they do the project leadership for us. They contribute all their ideas to our organization. And we have those commitments, and they're connected in to our board independently in overseeing and assisting us in these matters.
Excuse me.
So as we look at this investment, this is a substantial investment into the core sales, marketing, and missions of our business, and it's a very large project. At the end of my remarks, I do want to cover off on some risk management in the organization. and how we're dealing with these challenges. Because of this investment, which is a very large one, and the nature of the investment does run through our P&L, we have announced that our guidance is we're expecting to come in between a $25 to $33 million loss this year, with EBITDA at a negative $11 million. Obviously, our core operating business still do generate cash, so they are paying for part of this expansion. So that's where we go through into 2018. I want to talk about some of the ways that we're managing the risks around this substantial project and how we can move ourselves to profitability as we look at the success of that project as we move forward. We have communicated publicly. We are a public company, so I'm restricted by certain matters of what I can share. But our public announcement is we do expect ourselves to be profitable into 2019 and then substantially grow our operating earnings in 2020. This is a multi-year plan. McKinsey's engagement is 15 to 18 months on site. I want to touch on some risk management now, because I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about these very important things in this investment process that we've gone into in our organization. So the first part of this is we carry $68 million of cash as of a couple of weeks ago. That is a substantial amount of cash as a ratio to our overall equity and a component of our balance sheet. So in that initial investment that was made by our new capital partner, Calisthenium Capital, and the way our business does generate cash, we sustained a substantial amount of cash in order to support this investment. So when looking at our ability to pay for the investment, we don't need to reach out and get more cash. We don't need to create other sources of liquidity. We actually have the cash to deploy. Further to that, as I mentioned already a couple of times, an important remark earlier is, do our core businesses generate EBITDA? And they do. We have some additional expansion that we've done, so it's that EBITDA is eaten up a little bit by those. But to a certain degree, the EBITDA that we do generate from our business is taking out much of the cost expansion that we had planned. So from a $2 million last year to up to $33 million per current guidance, substantially those costs are related to our expansion in marketing, our consultant fees, and other sales and marketing related activities to support this analysis and expansion. Additional risk management opportunities. We do have the ability, and we've been active, and I will be continuing to work on that activity to borrow. We do own buildings, and we have some other open sources of liquidity. We're evaluating those options. We have a lot of cash now, but we're always interested in how we can support liquidity. And then finally, with respect to risk management, there is a, with McKinsey on board, we do have a very rigorous internal project management system and a report out to our board of directors. And our new chairman is very active in the day-to-day management process of this project. And then last remarks on governance. I've only been with the organization for 9 days. It's part of the reason why we have some support here for some questions. I'm somewhat limited on what I can do on details, but clearly these strategies I've talked with our CEO and our board of directors is that I have, with the substantial reduction in costs on infrastructure in 2017, my review in the early period is that the company has adjusted to those resource levels, and we've been effective in our security infrastructure support in managing our controls around financial reporting. That was been reinforced through my, so I can observe that externally before I came in. It's been reinforced through my initial scan through the organization, and I have met with our external auditors and was pleased with their feedback on the organization. So that was a few more minutes of open remarks than I wanted to. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity just to share that initial preview, and I'm very happy to answer any questions. And to the extent, I apologize, this is the first time with the board. I've been through other regulators, but to the extent that we can't answer questions satisfactorily here, we'll submit a response back through whatever the formal channel is appropriate.
Impressive for 9 days.
No notes.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Your Chair at Lead is Mr. Jacob.
Thank you. I was going to say it's probably the longest open statement I've ever had.
I'm so glad I trimmed it.
So, talk to me a little more about this 18 forecast. Now, you're saying $25 to $35 million loss. You were projecting down in low digits, single digits for new starts, down in low single digits for overall population. Is that still valid, or are we talking a little larger losses now in those new student overall population?
The overall student population, that's interesting, because we were now in the second inning, I'm calling it, in our program, and so we're starting to see traction, especially in the marketing area, but some of these are some of the areas where we're, you know, there's different parts to the funnel and the length of time before a student comes in, and we are seeing some traction in just those changes. So right now we're just trying to analyze it. We do believe we're right now trying to target our starts as within that guidance that we've included. We'll know more in the next couple of months, and we'll be communicating those through our required public channels.
So part of the transformation or items you were going to do on your last visit was start some new programs, welding and CNC machining. I see it started in two locations. It was supposed to start in Arizona in January. Did that happen? And have you rolled those programs out more than just the two locations, and how is that going?
Yes, I think, Lori, do you have the specifics on this?
We, in 2017, we started welding at a ranch in Humongous Memphis. We started the CNC machine program at NPI all in 2017. We did start welding in January of 2018 at our Avondale campus. And we're also seeking regulatory support to start welding also at our Dallas campus in FY19, that day.
Quick, I apologize. I did, believe it or not, left off one small remark. Okay, thanks. When we talk about the risk management side, there's about $25 million in this current loss period that we can quickly portably pull out if we needed to. And that's in the composition of $11 million of marketing spend. It's probably more, but I can conservatively say that we've expanded that much, and if it's not effective, we can pull it back. We have $7 million in consulting spend. If we're not successful, we're not going to keep the consultants, right?
It's a concern if you're projecting possibly $35 million loss. That's half the money for the capital infusion to just receive.
You know, absolutely. And we also, our Bloomfield office is, as we're just about to launch, is going to be about $7 million of expense in the P&L this year, and it turns profitable in 15-18 months. So just in terms of recovering, you know, if the backstop to the whole strategic initiative around sales and marketing is those expenses can be pulled back very quickly. I'm sorry. Thanks, Greg.
Can you talk a little bit more about real estate optimization? So you've talked about opening up these smaller computer type of campuses. I've been out to the Avondale campus. It's huge. So what's the update on really optimizing those large footprints? Because it's got to cost you a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I personally don't have the specifics. I have the general. Yes, we're doing lots of that. Does anyone on the team just have specifics about the Avondale that we've communicated publicly?
With all your large.
Okay.
Too. I mean, is the real estate optimization including reducing those footprints, saving money that way?
Yes, absolutely, and we're, you know, conservatively thinking that we can spend on a run rate basis, save on a run rate basis about $2 to $3 million next year. So we're still going through the right sizing of the campuses.
But right size in terms of staffing, because the square footage is still there.
Yes, and that includes that.
Ms. Smith, it looks like you perhaps have something to say.
As our leases are expiring on our existing locations, or where there's an opportunity to work to adjust those, we are doing that. So we've done it at the Rancho Cucamonga location. We are doing it at Houston. Both of those will take place, I believe, at the end of FY18, maybe the beginning of FY19. We expect those two consolidations will actually giving up square footage in the building, reducing our rent expense, I think that's where we're expected to save about $2 million in FY19 and going forward from those. And I don't have details, but there, I know there is a plan as each of our locations, as our leases are expiring, to consolidate that and also actively working to adjust, you know, if we can, change the terms of some of our leases
right.
so that we can actually reduce the
exposure. Okay. Yeah. I think I did read in your notes that I think all your leases are coming up within
yes.
the next 5 years.
So. Yes. So I don't know the details, but I have seen a plan laid out of all the things that are currently in
place. Can you talk about default rates, please? Where are you seeing them trending?
You know, I apologize, Craig. I don't either, but I'm writing it down right now. We'll follow up with specifics.
With your transformation and the revamping of the admissions process, there was an interesting item about graduate-based variable commission plan. Can someone talk to me what that means?
Yeah, I can give you that at a high level. Is that as the regulations change, we were allowed to create variable compensation around successful graduates. And that program was installed. I apologize, I can't be specific, but I believe it. We started measuring it over a year ago. And so now that's starting to mature as we start seeing the graduates come through.
Okay. So refresh my memory again on your FY19 forecasting. We know what 18 is going to look like. We're projecting $25, $35 million loss. Talking about 19?
Absolutely, Craig. I can only be directional
right.
Given the nature of the firm, but we expect to be profitable and to have more profit and higher EBITDA in 2019.
So the question is, you know, will these initiatives be moved quickly enough to see the changes?
Yes. On a forecast basis, yes, we can do that. And as we, you know, as we evolve through a very complex project, we'll course correct on things. I'm sorry, I'm talking too close to the microphone. We'll course correct on tactics that have been successful and enhance them, and the ones that are unsuccessful, we'll peel back the resources.
All the questions I have.
Sure. Anyone else have questions?
Yeah, I just would like to understand that you have stated your forecast is you're going to have an operating loss of about $25 to $35 million, but you're going to be positive for EBITDA?
No, I'll clarify that. We'll be negative $11 million on EBITDA.
All right. Thank you.
The difference being our operations are paying for, on a cash basis, some of that decline.
Okay.
Appreciate that.
I have just a couple questions. How did you save $40 million last year?
On a general sense, we did have a reduction in primarily the administrative side of the business, less so on the sales, marketing, and admissions.
So that's what? Getting rid of the chief financial officer, the chief operating officer, and getting a new chairman? Or how, what other issues did you apply to get $40
million? I don't know the specifics.
Was it personnel?
I think it was primarily personnel.
Yep.
Significant reduction in force in October of 2016. A lot of home office, which is primarily... We tried to not focus on marketing, admissions, or student-facing positions. We right-sized the campuses from an instructor perspective based on existing student loads and what our need was. But it was primarily a lot of home office and administrative leadership positions. We just consolidated leaders to take over.
And in the Arizona locations, what kind of reductions were made at those campuses?
I don't know specifically at the campus location.
We can follow up, Craig.
I did just look up the cohort default rate since we actually have Wi-Fi there now. It looks like at two of the OPIDs, they essentially stayed the same, and one it went down.
Okay.
It is three OPIDs.
So you have... UTI hired McKinsey to come in and do analysis. I thought I heard you say it might cost as much as $7 million. for the consulting, outside consulting?
Yeah.
You had $4 million in here on your cost, the agreement you announced.
Yeah, so there's a base fee, and then they own a performance basis. So they're participating in the success and the risk of the program. And so we're projecting success, and so we're anticipating a certain level of expense with them. And there was two parts of the engagement. There was the initial engagement for the analysis, which started in the fall, and then this actual program has another set of contracts.
And who's the current CEO?
Kim McWaters.
Very long time. It's been there quite a while, yeah. Right? Anybody else know Bob Sweet?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Bob started this back in the 60s.
Okay, yeah.
Probably would be pretty surprised that you're spending that kind of money. But anyway, that's what you need to do.
Sure.
Pretty simplistic business, as businesses go. We just need more students.
Absolutely.
but we're all very curious what McKinsey could possibly add to that. So, but it sounds like you have a plan. Why is it that you can't financially, when you open up these new schools, why isn't most of that expense amortized and falling on the balance sheet rather than your operating statement?
Yeah, I think so. So there's a healthy portion that's capitalized as CapEx. And so approximately, I'm going to ballpark it, roughly 60% of the costs are capitalized. But we do have other, you know, non-buildouts, non-capitalized expenses as we start putting in teachers, infrastructure, our own resources to establish that. We have to fill up the organization that we can't capitalize. And so roughly $7 million of that is going through our P&L this year.
And you're going to open two of these this year in 2018?
One.
Just one?
Yep.
So most of the loss is going to be attributable to opening one school?
Of the $33 million? No, most of the loss is attributable to our expansion in marketing. So we're spending over $16 million more in marketing, and we have other spend associated with the consultants that are supporting us. And then, and so those are the two biggest chunks. And then we have other things that we've invested in, including changes in management, some infrastructure parts on sales and marketing. We're looking at technology as our, we see some clear opportunities to have a better student experience from admissions to enrollment.
So yeah, what is it? It's like 2000, 2001 or something. It's a long time.
Yep. Yep.
Look there, and a decade or less. Okay, are there any other questions or concerns? All right. Mr. Chase, are you interested in making a motion?
And Director, do we have a new calculation for the surety bond? Based on here, you want, you're looking at 7.57?
There was a new calculation, yes.
Okay, I'll make a motion to approve the license renewal for MMI and UTI with the stipulation that surety bond in the amount of $3.757,900 is posted, and we will continue to have you provide electronic copies of student records.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Do you agree with stipulations?
Yes.
Any discussion? All right. All those in favor?
Director
Jacob,
yay.
Dick Lee,
yay. Dr. Jennifer Leck, yay.
Bill Vance Wool,
yay.
All right. It passes. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You.
We'll see what you can do by day 10 or 11.
Big objectives.
All right, the next item on the agenda. Arizona Christian University.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. At your May 2017 meeting, the State Board approved the 2017 license renewal for Arizona Christian University by stipulated agreement that they post a $300,000 surety bond, which had previously been revised from your April meeting, and to provide electronic student records on a quarterly basis, which they have done. ACU was required to submit a notice report to HLC on February 1st, 2018, and hosted a focus visit in March of 2018. The team report on page 18 stated that evidence demonstrated, but HLC recommended follow-up for a report in June of 2019. In the HLC letter dated May 4th from Ms. Sweeney, it indicated that the HLC Commission will review all reports and responses from the institution and to recommend remove notice at your at the November 2018 meeting. Your board member lead is Ms. Leonard and Mr. Van Zwal. And here representing the institution is Mr. Lynn Munzel, president, and Dr. Steve Adamson.
You come forward, please. Yourselves for the record, please.
Sure. I'm Lynn Munzel, president of Arizona Christian University.
Steve Adamson, provost and chief operating officer of Arizona Christian University.
Is there
an opening
statement?
There is.
Is it as long as the last guy's?
No. Madam Chair and members of the board, thanks for this opportunity to come back before you on the annual license renewal. The 2017-18 academic year was one of the most successful in the 60-year history of our institution. We graduated our largest class in history by a significant margin, with 175 students receiving bachelor's degrees. Only 5 years ago, we topped 100 students for the first time, 100 graduates for the first time. We had our fourth consecutive year of record enrollment with more than 800 total students in all programs. We're closing in on our third consecutive year of finishing in the black, which I know you understand is always great news for small universities. We did receive approval last year from our accreditor to offer all of our degrees in a distance format. And so that began with our first fully online students last fall of 2017. Also last fall, Arizona Christian University received its first best colleges ranking in its history from the U.S. News and World Report. Our rank of 16th best regional college in the West was the highest rank in its category of any university in the state of Arizona. So we were very thankful for that recognition, and that certainly helped
with
recruitment. Perhaps most significantly, as was mentioned.
Excuse me. People on the phone, could you please mute it?
We're hearing background conversations.
Anyone have a phone or their computer? Excuse me, people on the phone, could you please mute your phones?
In the program, both the RN and the MSN program, as well as
Excuse me, we will be hanging up. If you need to call back in, please do so, so we can get rid of this background conversation.
Does that count against my time?
No.
All right, good.
And actually, since the
president helps,
Seth, you may have as much time as you want, but we'll wait until it dials back in.
Okay.
Pressure's on.
Welcome to CenturyLink Conferencing. Please enter your passcode. Please hold while I confirm your passcode. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the third person to join the meeting.
Can we mute them?
Is that kid's gotta be Kimberly Wallace, right? Because she's on the phone.
They said there were three people on the phone. Joe and Kimberly.
This is Joe. I just called back in. It's not me talking.
Yeah, this is Kim and Chad, and we just called back in. We're not talking either.
Is your phone muted?
Yes, they are.
Yes.
That's very strange.
Oi, speak a little louder.
Sure. Okay. And finally, and most significantly, as was mentioned, we did have a follow-up visit from a team at the Higher Learning Commission to evaluate our progress in several areas following our 2016 mid-cycle review that had resulted in a notice designation, and which was an indication that while we were meeting all criteria for accreditation, they had concerns in several areas. In very pleased to report that we had a great visit with the team and the recommendation to the board of the Higher Learning Commission is to remove the notice designation as they saw significant progress in every area of concern. They did ask for a report, not a visit, but a report to be filed next year, I believe in one area, which was the area of overall institutional planning. So we were very pleased with that visit, with that report, and we look forward to update you and answer any other questions that you might have about ACU. Thank you.
First, on your default rate, it looks like you have a pretty low rate of students in financial aid. So even though your default rate is creeping up, it's really very few students. You have in the low 20s of people getting financial aid, and so it's a small population. And it's still a low default rate, but it still is creeping a little bit. So that's something to watch out for. And just because there's so few on financial aid, it might be something that's not getting a lot of attention, because it seems like a little thing, but it can become a big thing if you don't keep an eye on it.
Right. Okay, thank you.
My stuff is all not very exciting, but I will ask it all anyway. In your eligibility requirements on page 22 of your catalog, it looks like your people played it safe and copied and pasted from Department of Ed publications, which helps get you not in trouble for using incorrect verbiage, which is nice. But you may have included something that doesn't apply to you. It talks about enrolling in an eligible career pathway program, and it's not likely that you have that. You may, but it's quite a rarity. So just check, and if you don't have that, then just make sure that the eligibility requirements you listed are actually applicable to you as a school. You may have a student who asked about it when you don't have it.
Great. Thank you.
Under private loans, on page 28 of your catalog, says private loans are only adjusted upon request of the student. Returning excess funds remains the responsibility of the student. This is in your refund policy. I just don't know what that means. It probably means that any excess would go to the student rather than loan, but it's just not very clear, so it would be easy to make that a little bit clearer. It looks like you did a good job with the HLC 8 areas. You have satisfied 6 of the 8. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the other 2 and how you feel about getting a better report card next time on those 2.
Dr. Adamson?
Yeah, the other 2 that they indicated that they would like some future additional reporting
revolve around monitoring in a different format than we had been doing, student and teacher faculty load, and making sure that's in an upfront planning cycle so that it's more clear as to the progression that we're intending to make for faculty increase in certain areas. And so that it was a request on the site visit people to move away from a faculty teacher ratio analysis and analyze down at the credit hour taught level, and then just incorporate that into a planning structure. So that's what they wanted to see us implement.
Is that working for you?
Yes.
How are your evening online programs doing? That was new the last time you were here.
Evening have been going on for a while, and it is fairly stable in its enrollment of around the mid-50s or 60 students. Most of the new students, when they're presented with the option of either an evening class or an online, they're migrating towards online. That's a brand new program approved in May, launched in the fall, but most of the curriculum began to go online in January. So that's just getting rolling. So the combined of the evening and online from the fall of in the mid-50s to now mid-80s, and then growth projections to be around 150 to 200 by the end of next year. So the whole marketing and advertising and curriculum development of that is on track.
So if the evening students are to a large degree transitioning to online, will you be able to continue to offer the programs and courses for the remaining evening students who don't choose to go online?
Yeah, we have enough evening enrollment for all those classes to make, and so it becomes a hybrid option for the evening student. Should for that particular term they have a conflict with work, they can opt for that session to take an evening class. So we're finding a great deal of our evening students are doing a hybrid model, but there's enough enrollment for the classes to be able to make.
We've also learned that there are some evening students that are returning to college that really want to be in a classroom, that really want to have the peer relationships, and of course that's something that's unique about a smaller university is the relationships that are formed. So we believe that enrollment's going to not just be stable, but will continue to grow moderately, but we expect the online to grow more rapidly.
I was just asking because sometimes, as you said, some students who would prefer to go and sit in a seat may be turned off if their only option is to take online, and a lot of schools currently are kind of forcing students that as they go through the program, they find their courses that are not offered any longer. They started off thinking they all would be in person, and then they need a course to graduate, and it's only offered online. But you're protecting the evening that those students will be able to go.
Yes.
That's fine. EA to be sort of unique, but you met the requirements, so we'll skip on that.
Okay.
Anyone else have any questions?
You just had a site visit by the Higher Learning Commission, right?
Yes.
Can you summarize for the board like the major findings from them? So I'm seeing some areas where they have concerns about you not being able to meet certain core components. Maybe you can just summarize.
Well, those flowed from the mid-cycle review in 2016. It was interesting because it was like they had one area of concern in each of the core areas. So when you added it up, it looked like there were concerns in all of the core components. But typically, most of them, we met with no concerns. But there was one area that they had a concern. So the ones that I think we largely addressed, they had some questions about governance. They had questions about finances at the school. They had some questions about our how we tracked our alumni and determined how they were doing in their careers in graduate school. And I believe those were the ones that were addressed. Dr. Adamson, I don't know if you want to add anything to the list of concerns that were addressed at the March meeting, but all that were remaining is what he mentioned related to how we plan for faculty growth, basically as our student population grows, and how we integrate that planning into the larger university planning.
Yeah, and in the report that we have from the site visit team, the way they identify on the items that they wanted to look at, anything that's checked off as evidence demonstrates, that's essentially in their view, that's the terminology of, has been satisfied. And the only difference is whether they would like a follow-up report maybe a year later to just to see how, another status report. And so that's what we had in.
They only asked for that in one of the eight areas.
One of them.
Is that the one about faculty load and
faculty
number of
load and how
staffing?
That gets into planning.
And planning, primarily.
Can you briefly explain the governing board autonomy situation and how that's
sure.
corrected?
Well, in essence, they had a concern. A lot of smaller institutions that are tuition-dependent, donor-dependent, in fact, I read one survey that said 40% of them had some sort of financial relationship with board members. So we have a conflict of interest policy. We follow the conflict of interest policy. So every conflict, potential conflict, was declared. Board members recused themselves from any discussion related to what they were doing. But primarily what they were doing in some circumstances was we had set up a fund that not just board members but others put into that was basically operating as a line of credit outside of a commercial lending normal circumstance, and they didn't like that. And it's sort of a new thing that they've emphasized that they felt like made it difficult for the institution to have enough board members engaging on some of those discussions. So we
right, they said we, like 11 board members may have to recuse right. themselves.
Well, no, there were 11 board members, and there were, I think, the most we ever had was four that were involved. And they were concerned about the other seven making financial decisions.
Four, yeah.
Yeah. And so we eliminated that fund and basically established a new requirement that no board members, no members of our Board of Trustees can make loans to the school.
Very good. And then talk to me a little bit about the systematic planning concerns they have, you know, what you have done to work towards a more efficient planning process.
The plan
very
sure.
quickly, so
yeah, the planning process implemented is a tight feedback loop from assessment to budgeting to setting the next direction, and rather than having a five-year strategic plan, which you come back and look at it every 5 years. We've implemented a rolling five-year strategic plan. So, every March and April, we pull in the assessments of how we're performing, and that gets from everything from operations to academics to the budgetary side. That gets rolled into our budget planning, which influences more faculty hiring and an analysis of what adjustments we want to make to our strategic plan. Then we republish the strategic plan in the fall for another five-year outlook. And so it's a continuous five-year rolling strategic plan. And so that's something new that's implemented. And it's very helpful for us in the sense that we are growing rather rapidly. So things shift. And so having a strategic plan that's just anchored out there for 5 years and you come back later is not a quick enough repeat or a relook at it. So that's what's been implemented.
This, just one final question on their comment about the evaluation of postgrad student success. What has been the history at the school regarding that area, and what are you doing now? What are your plans to do to really evaluate postgrad student success?
Yeah, we have a within our student development, student life, we have a career services segment of that, and then as well as in our advancement alumni relations. So a full-up database where we keep track of all the students.
How many staff members are in your career services?
The career services, when you put everybody in student life, student development, there's involved in that. You know, quick count, there's that would be three who were involved in that. And then the advancement team is also involved heavily because they have the alumni relations as well.
So I have some financial questions. You know, last year you were losing money, you had negative cash flows. So give us an update on what this year looks like and what actions you've taken to change the direction of the financial performance.
Sure, and then I'll let Dr. Adamson respond to this as well. We have, you know, with small institutions, the generating revenue and understanding what you need to do to generate enough revenue to cover expenses, we've sort of made a shift in our thinking from an expansion standpoint. In fact, at our current campus, we're on the edge of being at capacity for what we can serve on our 20-acre campus on Cactus Road. And so the emphasis is going to be growing the evening and online, which have higher profit margins. The other thing is we're a sort of a niche offering as a more conservative, traditional Christian university. And there are people that want to support that. And so we've been really emphasizing building the donor base. One of the things you may have seen in there is that we had a major donor event in March in California. Our budget this year for fundraising was about $1.7 million. It's funny, 'cause I'm listening to these other numbers that were being thrown around earlier, and I'm thinking, man, this shouldn't be that hard, you know. But we've already raised over $2.4 million in this fiscal year. And we believe that's going to increase because there are people that are really excited about supporting the university. So it's a combination of the growth in the future for the university being in the higher profit margin areas and continuing to grow a donor base that wants to see an institution that's smaller. You know, one of the things that we offer is the unique relationships that form between faculty and students and that carry on beyond graduation. And so combining the growing financial support with increasing enrollment in higher profit margin areas, which we never had before. I mean, the evening, we're a 60-year-old institution. We've only had the evening program for 8 years, and online, as we talked about, just began last fall. And we don't need huge numbers. We don't need, you know, we don't want or need 5 or 10,000 online students. Just having 200 to 300 makes a huge difference in an organization our size.
How are you doing on
that? You know, we're off to a good start. We had started initially looking at partnerships with other entities that have experience in this area, revenue share partnerships. And we've gone away from that. So we're working more on with our own team using affinity marketing. The result of that will be that we will grow at a much slower pace, but we'll be able to serve the students much better, and we'll keep all of the revenue. So again, we're not looking to, you know, a rocket ship takeoff. It's going to be a steady growth in that area.
How many students do you have?
Full online. We are at 25 students, starting at zero in the fall. And really, the fall, even though we launched, it was
we didn't have all the programs.
Pretty much internal pilot. So it wasn't until January that we had the degrees and the curriculum and the programs up. So at 25 now, we'll probably be pushing 50 just online only by the fall, and projecting to be above 100 online only by the end of the next fiscal year. And then you add in the evening students, and it puts us in the 150 range to 200 possible total.
You were using a third party previously,
mm-hmm,
to do that, and so you severed that relationship?
Yeah, actually, they went out of business right when we got approved. So so we didn't have a choice in that, but we're actually kind of pleased the way it worked out.
So do you have designated advisors, enrollment advisors for online, or how do you
yes yeah, we do. We have three designated enrollment advisors for the evening and the online programs, dedicated person on doing the curriculum development and a dedicated person for student success and orientation training.
Did you have to commit a significant amount of revenue to the marketing and development of the online?
No, actually, we did not. Part of the value of the success that we've had in our campus operation is that the name is out, the brand is out, and we are essentially at capacity, and so we know exactly what we need to spend in that and to continue that enrollment. And so the excess that we had been planning, we were able to quite easily shift over into the online side and without making a major investment.
Just 20-something students, were you able to offer sufficient courses? Mm-hmm. We had to cancel them because we didn't have enough bodies?
Yeah, and the number of 20-some students, those are students who are actually enrolled as degree-seeking online students only. But because we are, with our campus enrollment, since we are have a high number of student athletes, there are times for several of those students where there is conflict between the daytime campus course and their practice time. You know, volleyball practices it from 7 to 8:30, and that's when English is. Then our campus students are able to take an online class as an alternate, and so really we're probably close to 200 students enrolled in an online class, with quite a few of those being our campus students that are helping make those numbers, so those classes make, but actually technically enrolled as a degree seeking student in the online, it does seem smaller, but we've got plenty of additional registration to make those classes go.
Are you using adjuncts or are you using full-time faculty for those?
We use a combination of both.
Do you have mentors or other non-professor role that helps the students on the online?
Yes, we have an academic center, a testing and an academic progress and success center that gets plugged into all of the students, whether they're campus or evening or online.
Another question? And I make a motion to approve the regular degree granting license renewal with a stipulated agreement to maintain the $300,000 bond and continue to provide electronic copies of student records on a monthly basis.
Second.
All right, I have a motion second. Do you agree to those stipulations?
Yes, we do.
All right.
Mike Romano?
Aye.
Craig Jacob? Yay.
Chris Leonard? Aye.
Aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck? Aye.
Bill Lanswell?
Aye.
All right, congratulations and
thank you.
Good luck. Continued success.
Thank you, appreciate it. And congratulations on the new digs. This is very nice.
It's much nicer, huh?
Mine too.
And thank you also for your patience of the shuffle of the agenda.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
The next item is the regular vocational program and degree granting license renewal.
Yes, Madam Chair. This is a license renewal for AI and Argosy. I'm not sure if you want to consider them separately or both together.
Okay.
Regarding the Art Institute, at your meeting last year in August of 2017, the board approved a regular vocational degree granting license for the Art Institute of Phoenix by stipulated agreement to maintain the $2,043,700 surety bond, continue quarterly reporting before the board, and to begin providing the student educational records to us electronically on a quarterly basis. AI Phoenix has complied with all the requirements. In October of 2017, the Dream Center Education Holdings, LLC, purchased many of the schools that were previously owned by EDMC. The purchase did include the four Arizona locations, the Art Institute of Phoenix, the two Argosy, Phoenix, and Chandler campuses, and the EDMC Cost Center. On January 25th, 2018, the state approved the supplemental license application for a change of ownership for the above institutions with the stipulation that stipulated agreement for the Yard Institute remain in full force and effect. And at this point, the AI Phoenix and both Argosy are seeking renewal. And your board member lead is Mr. Lukey. Here representing the institution is Shelley Murphy with the Dream Center, Chad Williams, AI Phoenix Campus President, and Anthony Spano, AI Argosy Campus President. I believe Kimberly Walsh is on by phone.
Somebody. Yes.
Yes, thank you. Kimberly, is someone else on as well?
Yes, Chad Williams. He's the Chief Financial Officer, if there's any of those questions.
Chad? Oh, he's here.
Yeah, Garrett.
Chad Garrett, sorry.
Chad Williams is here.
Chad Garrett? Confuse me. Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Well, welcome. Do you have an opening statement?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
You just didn't want to be in competition, right?
No.
Well, we appreciate the brevity there. Just a few questions just to kind of get up to speed on the whole transition. Right now, Art Institute is a branch campus of Argosy University. Is that how it's...
Through WASC, that's my understanding.
Through WASC it is.
Okay, so, well, I have questions on your accreditation. So, currently, you're accredited by whom?
Argosy University is currently accredited by WASC, and it's also programmatically accredited by, you know,
lots of
times.
Okay.
And the Art Institute of Phoenix is currently accredited by ACICS. We also have approval from WASC to be a branch of Argosy, and we are awaiting final DOE approval.
Yes, we're pending the Department of Ed to reassign the OPIDs.
Okay. And then at that time, will you then be viewed as a branch of Argosy University?
Yes.
That is correct.
Okay. And then the OPID number will be Argosy's?
It will be reassigned with WASC being the accreditor, but it will still remain as it is. So it won't.
You'll still have separate ID numbers?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And in terms of the managers of the Dream Center, just to be, I want to see if there's any updates that you can provide. So Brent Richardson is still
CEO.
CEO. Randall Barton is still
Chief Development Officer.
And Reverend Matthew Barnett is still board member.
Board member, yes.
Timothy Slotow.
Yes, there's been no changes to the board.
Okay, so everything we see here, Dr. Rufus Glasbar, Jack DeBartolo, they're all?
All the same.
Okay, very good. On your renewal application, I just had a couple questions on showing a net income loss of $130,000, and it looks like there's some sort of debit of $507,000 that occurred in the very last quarter of 17. But I have no idea what that is and whether or not it'll be reoccurring.
Chad Garrett, can you address that question?
I apologize. I'm not, I don't think I have what you have in front of you. You're saying this is the renewal application?
Yes.
I'm looking. I'm heading that direction, but
Shelley.
Apologies. We're kind of digging that out. If we could circle back with that.
Is that what we're talking about, the gain on the purchase? The acquisition?
No, it doesn't appear to be the gain.
No.
It's
the reduction of revenue.
Reduction of revenue by $500,000.
For the Arizona location.
Kim, was that submitted on the most recent P&Ls that we put through, Kim?
No, this is actually the renewal that would have been sent in March that we're looking for.
Okay. Well, if you should find it, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Gross tuition for the Art Institute is $19
million? Correct.
Which one? Okay. In your renewal application, it talks about the Art Institute of Phoenix combined, which includes the Art Institute of Phoenix as one of its institutions. What other institutions make up that combination?
So the Art Institute of Phoenix, as part of ACICS, is the main campus for the Art Institute of Indianapolis, the Art Institute of Las Vegas, the Art Institute of...
So they're all under the one ID number of Phoenix Art
Correct.
Institute.
Correct.
Okay, and does Argosy control those?
Not currently.
Okay. And, but they, those other schools enjoy, I use that word loosely, ACICS recognition?
Yes, they do currently, but will be WASC.
So the other ones, the plan is to fold those back into under Argosy, is that
correct?
So on the composite score is still a combination of all four schools. Art Institute Phoenix.
And the branches.
Vegas.
Yeah.
So on and so forth. Okay.
If I could,
yes.
Kim?
Yes?
The net loss that they were speaking of is on the Art Institute license renewal, page 14. It's on the financial table grid.
Correct, and that is actually what we're looking for our copy of.
Okay.
One point of curiosity is there's been a lot of talk in the press about Mr. Richardson's involvement with the WASU. Is that how we refer to it?
WASU.
WASU. Okay. Is WASU providing any services currently at the Art Institute in Phoenix?
No.
Okay. So they're completely siloed, separate.
Yes.
And what substantive changes have you seen since the transition from EDMC to the Dream Center? Would yesterday's, say, a graduate from 3 years ago notice much difference?
There has been no operational changes to speak of for the most part. I think the students have really embraced the idea of being a nonprofit institution and are very excited about the transition, as are the faculty and staff, but there is no operational impact that the students would see at this time.
Okay. And at Argosy, one of the great things that we've seen is a clinical psychology program. Our team has been able to go to Arizona State University and talk to their senior class since this acquisition has happened, this merger. And so prior to that, we weren't allowed to do that. So we're going to see some really additional gains through just being nonprofit and being able to go to other state universities and present to them.
Is there any Department of Education actions pending?
No.
Everything's completed with them?
Yeah, I mean, we're pending the tail end of just some documentation that's due, but there are no actions pending.
So in the nonprofit status, how are you able to get that out to your students? Right now, you are officially nonprofit, but just simply waiting for Department of Ed recognition of the WASC decision to accredit?
Yes, and we're currently just pending our final participation agreements as well.
Okay.
We are on temporary, but recognized as not-for-profit.
Okay. And so is that reflected in the catalog? The last catalog that you provided the board was from October of 17. Do you have a new catalog? And if so, can you provide that to the board?
We could do that in follow-up.
Okay, that's all the questions I have.
Maybe talk about some of your program outcomes in regards to completion and then also placement.
Sure. Would you like from Argosy or Art Institute?
Art
or?
Institute.
Sure. As currently obligated to ACICS, we are following ACICS's program verification process, and those numbers are in the car. So we do have a dedicated career services staff at the campus that works with graduates 6 months before they're actual graduates and then 6 months after. We also hold what are called portfolio reviews for all of our programs to really bridge the graduate with the employer or employment community. And again, all of our specific placement data is right now under ACICS's guidelines and is in the CAR, which I could provide you if you would like to see the actual CAR.
Are any of those that are not maybe in teach out that are not currently meeting the expectations of placement outcome?
We did receive a program withdrawal letter from ACICS
for three programs,
and the state was copied on that document. We have complied with all of the requirements of that notification.
And how are the other programs in relation? Are they close to that benchmark, or are they close to falling below that benchmark? Or as I'm trying to reconcile, as you're now what I interpreted gaining more access based on your nonprofit status to bring in more students, but yet seeming to struggle on employment outcomes and verification. I'm just trying to reconcile that piece, I guess.
The other programs are above from benchmark. The three programs that were identified, two of them have extremely small cohorts. One of them only has three graduating classes, so it actually, you know, with that number of graduates, a very difficult decision. And the other program that was impacted, there was significant industry changes that employers left the metropolitan area, and that greatly impacted that particular program, and that would be the largest one.
How do you go about evaluating what your market looks like for the programs that you're offering?
We do that through our PAC committees, largely, our program advisory committees that meet several times a year and give us input in terms of the program outcomes and how they are matching up with what they're seeing in. So that would be the primary vehicle for us, would be our program advisory committees.
So I'm trying to appreciate the kind of the run rate you had over a number of years of where you underperformed in regards to placement outcomes with the program advisory councils and not being able to kind of help either move those up. It kind of took an action by the accreditor to basically force it to stop. I'm trying to appreciate maybe how you're going to avoid that in the future, as part of our role is to be that protection for the consumer. And obviously people have entered into these education processes ultimately over a period of time when you were struggling in regards to outcomes, and how that would be avoided moving forward. How do you see that?
But with the ultimate transition to WASC, it obviously outcomes are still very important, but the verification process is extremely different. I don't know how familiar you are with ACICS's verification process, but it is a very difficult process. It is a new process that was developed as ACICS was facing some of its own challenges with the Department of Education. So I do see the outcomes being very different in terms of how they're verified through WASC. Again, I would go back to my initial statement on the three programs that were identified as being extremely small cohorts. One, you know, very, very new, only three graduating classes, under 20 total graduates. And then the other program, the largest, had significant employers leave the metropolitan area that impacted the placement rates.
And what is the expectation from WASC for validating placement?
So we're still working through those details. I mean, we would literally have to send you their criteria.
It kind of sounded like it was easier than ACICS, and so I guess I don't know what it is.
To some degree, there are some easier steps, but probably not much easier. They're just going to be different than what we've been accustomed to through ACICS.
If you were to evaluate against using that proposed standard, how would your numbers have changed? Maybe that would help me.
So not having...
You've seen a significant increase in your ability to say, well, with ACICS, we don't meet, but with WASC, we're now above benchmark?
Yes, I do think we're going to see some more positive ratios on the WASC side than we have been through ACIS, but mostly because, as Chad described, ACIS tightened down a lot of their criteria because of the current challenges that they were going through.
Thank you.
Are you WASC accredited because that's where the Dream Center is located? Is that how that is? Like, because
no, we decided to apply through WASC because we actually had applications in at Middle State, and because of a delay in the closing, we did not have full communication as to whether Middle States was going to be able to accredit these schools. 2,500 students that would have been jeopardized and lost accreditation, so we did something that was probably not as conventional, but we went to WASC and asked if they would consider taking these schools on as accreditation, so we applied with them.
Even though they're not located in their territory?
But because we have an Argosy relationship.
I was going to say, isn't it because Argosy, the home state, is California?
Yes.
That's the whole reason.
Yes, that was the whole point for going to WASC, because of our Argosy relationship, yes.
Okay.
That's their home state. Okay. Argosy is the home state.
There are six art institutes that are already branches of Argosy. And there, it's a College of Argosy, the College of Creative Art and Design. So the transition is for these campuses to move and become, to join those other six locations.
And change the name? Or
no, it's no. The art, it's a branch of Argosy, right? Under a college.
With the Art Institute name or the different name?
With the Art Institute
name.
Okay. But most of the people that will facilitate Argosy, especially online, or here in Arizona?
Not necessarily.
No? Where are they?
Orange County in California.
Okay. So, you have an administrative center here?
We have an operations center here.
Okay. And what are they operating?
We're a service center for all of the facilities. Service center for all brands, for South, Argosy, and online.
That's the administrative center.
That's the Dream Center.
I'm trying to understand. So they're okay.
That's the Argosy, the home state for Argosy is in California. I think they used to be here, but it moved over there a couple years ago. Because I think they were acquired by HLC, so then they went over to WASC. Art Institute was always accredited by ACICS and was through Pittsburgh. They were a branch of Pittsburgh and then part of Minneapolis, and then all of this. And then Middle States had issues, and then at that point in time, that's when they switched the Art Institute to become a branch campus of Art Institute. The Dream Center was the previous EDMC call center. That's been here a long time. That always did the service student services and so on and so forth for the Art Institute, Argosy, and SAU.
Got it.
Okay.
You did a great job.
I shouldn't know it that well, to tell you the truth.
Right, any other questions? All right, would you like to make a motion?
We need to do this motion in two steps. First, I want to take the Art Institute. I move that we grant a renewal license to operate in the state of Arizona, and that the existing stipulations of having a surety bond, quarterly reporting, and providing the board with electronic copies of student records continue.
Is motion, do we have a second?
Okay, Jacob, second.
All right. Do you accept those stipulations?
Yes, we do.
Roll call, please.
Mike Romano, aye.
Craig Jacob, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Cliff Gee, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Vance Wool, aye.
Okay, now Argosy. I move to grant a renewal for their state license, and that with the stipulations that they post a surety bond of $832,000. Provide electronic copies of student records.
Motion, do we have a second?
Yeah, Mike Romano, second.
Do you accept those stipulations?
Would it be possible to, because of the scores that you're looking at, we are due audited financials December 31st, and we're also working that alongside with the Department of Ed to update our comp scores. We believe that the ratios will be much better, and an increased surety bond only creates more stress as we move forward to bring these into more stronger and more positive states. Would the board consider giving us an extension on the increase to that surety bond until we're able to produce our audited financials?
When would you expect those done?
December.
So you'd sit on an expired license for 6 months.
Would we be able to get an extension?
No.
You have the option of bringing the financials forward at that time, requesting the agenda to ask for a reduction.
Well, I think that the only situation would be is that we'll have already paid for the bond. We'll have to issue that bond immediately, and it does create some burdensome as we try to position as a nonprofit and we move these in a more positive state. But we could not be with an expired license either.
There's no option yet. It's expired, it's expired. The state requires an annual renewal.
I think we're applying it consistently across all institutions. So doing that wouldn't compare to other institutions who have to put the bond up in the exact similar situation.
And the last two schools did come forward, I think, 6 months later when they had their audited financial.
Okay. It sounds like that might be our only path then.
All right.
Sorry. So does that mean you are in agreement then?
Yes.
Roll call vote, please.
Michael Romano, aye.
Craig Jacob, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Dick Lutke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Vance Wool, aye.
Thank you, both licenses.
Oh, okay. Okay. There it is.
Thank you also for the shuffle in the agenda.
Thank you. You guys have a great day.
Thank you.
On the agenda is a regular vocational program license renewal for the Regional Center for Board of Health, CBA, College of Health Careers. Ms. Cantwell?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. During staff's review of the 2018 license renewal application for the Regional Center for Board of Health doing business as College of Health Careers, staff had concerns regarding the recent actions taken by ABHES and Ed's action regarding the June 30th, 2016 financial statements. Accordingly, the renewal is referred to the board for discussion and action. Regional Center for Border Health owns and operates rural health clinics, the San Luis Walk-in Clinic, and also provides it's also a training site for the MOS Medical Assistant Program. They also have other entities such as the Main Street Cafe that serves as the training site for the Food Service Management Course, and South Camp County Diagnostic Services serves for the RX and ultrasound services. Here representing the institution is Lorena
Sendejas.
Thank you. Eduardo
Figueroa.
And
Alex Tejeda.
I'll let you go. And your board member lead is Mr. Romano.
All right, thank you. Maybe introduce yourselves one more time for the group and then also bring us up to speed if you'd like to make an opening statement.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. My name is Lorena Sendejas, and I am the new campus administrator for the College of Health Careers from Regional Center for Border Health. Accompanying me today is Mr. Alex Bejerano, and he is the Director of Marketing and Public Relations, and also Mr. Edgardo Figueroa, and he is the Director of Western Arizona Health Education Center. And we are here today before you in behalf of Ms. Amanda Aguirre, who is the President and CEO of Regional Center for Border Health. And we are asking for your consideration and approval for our license renewal. We did receive an email from Terry in regards to some questions that regarding the financials, and Mr. Bejerano is here to address those questions as well. I did email, and I again apologize to Mr. Keith Blanchard for the late email yesterday in regards to enrollment agreements that were missing and with the renewal, and we did get those to him as soon as we could yesterday evening. So we are here at your disposal for any questions.
That's real quickly. I'm not sure if we got the third names, if we could have that.
My name is Lorena Sendejas, and I'm the campus administrator for the College of Health Careers. This is Alex Bejerano, and he is the Director of Marketing and Public Relations.
How do we spell that?
Yeah. Alex, A-L-E-X, and Bejerano.
It's B-E-J-A-R-A-N-O.
I guess.
And also Edgardo Figueroa.
You too, and we didn't have his name.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So maybe could we start with maybe giving us a little bit of an update on where it stands with EPES right now?
We are actually finished, and we did send all the requirements for the renewal and the license. I know that there was some discrepancies in regards to the employment placement data, and when I came on board, I did the new data, and we were up to par to the requirements, but we have not received any notification from them yet.
And you anticipate when to receive that notification?
They informed me that it takes about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent it April 25th.
It looked like in part of that we're providing student surveys as well.
That's
in the response.
Correct.
And it looked like you had about 10 total students
at that time for that program, yes.
Okay. Was that their survey, your survey?
What they did is whenever they came in for that audit last year, they provided the students some surveys. And it was kind of odd because the packet that was sent to them included the surveys, but I'm not sure where the miscommunication was with them. So what I did is I resent the whole surveys that they actually did receive because I received the packet, a copy of the packet that they received. So we just sent the surveys again. And what it is just a survey for the students to fill out if they enjoyed the class, if there were any discrepancies or anything that they didn't like, or the method of instruction and with the instructors as well.
Kind of going through the information in regards to the placement outcomes and what that looked like, I think you had it was at 67%. What did you resubmit?
I resubmitted a 78%.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
What caused the jump?
There was some discrepancies on the Excel spreadsheet. Depending if they're continuing their education, it was in the wrong area, so it declined or it decreased the percentages. But after speaking to the representatives from APHES, we had to put it in another form, and so that what increased. Plus, also, many of those students that were not, well, they were contacted, but we did not have any response from them. We actually went to do home visits, and we tried to contact them through social media, personal emails, continuously calling. We were able to make contact. So then we, their, our percentages increased because of that.
Okay. So there seems to be a little bit of discrepancy on like what programs are approved and what programs you have on the website. Maybe you could speak to that as well.
We have 7 total programs currently at Regional Center or our campus admin, College of Health Careers, and the ones that were in our license are no longer, which were the behavioral health technician, it was a direct care, the electronic health as well. Those are all canceled. They were at the Yuma site. Now we are in Summerton, Arizona, and now we have 7 programs, which are the medical coder and biller, the pharmacy technician, the phlebotomy technician, the medical office specialist, which substituted the medical assistant program. And we also have the nutrition and food service management. We have the caregiver and also the CNA class.
Is the caregiver a replacement for the direct care worker, or is that?
No, it is not. It is a new program that we have.
Mr. Romano, if I could clarify, the caregiver is not under our jurisdiction.
Yep.
Nor is the CNA program under our jurisdiction.
That's correct.
You will send us notifications. Are there students enrolled in any of those right now?
Not for the caregiver, no. CNA, yes, we do have. But as far as your, I know
that doesn't. The ones that were under our jurisdiction.
Yes, we do have the medical office specialist currently running. And phlebotomy just started on Monday.
How about the medical coder and biller training?
Not yet.
Okay, if you could verify with Kim and I exactly what programs that we have, that we show that our license are currently operating.
They are all operating. We just don't have, the only class right now being held because there's students and currently in class are for medical office specialists and phlebotomy. The other classes were still pending student enrollment.
Okay, I think I'm confused. Okay. I thought we showed around 12 license program, but then it was only that you're operating 7?
We only have 7. We do not have 12.
So I think, for example, you still show the behavioral health technician program as...
And I think that's where the confusion is at. I apologize.
Right. So I think there's maybe some opportunity post this to kind of get all that clean.
I did. I emailed Kim and Mr. Keith Fletcher.
So I guess my next kind of series of questions are a little more related to your website.
Okay.
For example, and this is a little bit overlap of the programs that are called out there and trying to get that clarity because there's inconsistencies between what the board has listed and then what you have listed as approved by the board and just trying to get that clarity. So maybe could you talk to me about who governs your website and the information that's on the website?
I can answer that. We contract out with a local group in Yuma, Arizona called MGM Designs. And so they are the ones that produce our website for us. And then we do have the ability to edit some parts of the website in-house. And we also have in the IT department, headed by Mr. Gladney, who's not present today. And so, you know, he can also access the website and make changes to that.
And who's responsible for the content, like verifying the content is accurate on the website?
For the college, I am.
Okay. So some of the things I'm trying to appreciate are what appears to be very outdated information. For example, the annual security report is over a year old. The crime log is back to about 2014. So it's 3 years potentially out of date on that. In addition, the student's right to know as posted on the website as well is about 2015. So I'm just, I guess that's where I'm trying to kind of get my arms around, like, if I were a consumer going on the website, right, it seems like some of the most critical information is very inconsistent.
And to that, I'm sorry, Mr. Romano, I don't mean to interrupt you. However, we, Ms. Senda has recently came on board within the past 3 months, I believe. So that might have been my oversight that I wasn't, you know, I wasn't aware that we were supposed to be updating that information. So now that she is on board, we will definitely take a look at that and bring that information current.
Are you then serving as kind of the compliance officer as well?
For the college, yes.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Kind of moving on to the catalog a little bit. Another area of opportunity, you provided a catalog to us, but you have the older version on the on your website.
Yes, we do. And I did bring to for the board a draft copy of the new catalog. We are still pending some approval from the VA and also by APHES in order for it to be approved to get printed. But I did bring a copy if you wish to see it.
Okay. Just kind of referring off of both of them, and this is just perspective of it that I'm trying to offer. On page 2 of the catalog that you provided to us, so I'm referring to that one. It may have been changed, but it refers to the college being the only to offer fast track in quotes for allied health in the Southwest. Can you just help me appreciate what fast track is?
What that is our programs are geared for students not in a semester course as a regular college. What we do is we offer courses that ranges from 2 weeks to 14 weeks. So, for example, the medical quarter in Biller is a 14-week class, which includes all the lecture hours, the lab, the clinicals. That's why it's constituted as a fast track.
And how do you validate, and in fairness, you may not be able to answer this.
Try.
Because how do you validate that there are no other schools in the Southwest that offer some type of adjusted timeline in their delivery program?
There is not in Yuma County. We are the only fast-track college in Yuma County. In Arizona, obviously not. There's other colleges in Arizona.
So I think some subtleties in wording, like when you say Southwest, people can interpret Southwest as something beyond that of Yuma.
We are Southwest of Arizona, which is Yuma County.
I'm totally with you that your relation is, but people have different interpretations of the word Southwest.
I understand.
Most people assume that's California.
Right.
I understand.
Right. So
it
becomes a much broader region,
right,
where,
right,
it's like, wow, you're really exclusive here on the southern part
of the United States.
Right?
I see that. Yes. Yes.
If we were to specify Southwest Arizona, or would you prefer it to Yuma County?
I would ask you to review that and just give thought to it. What we're always most sensitive to is how a consumer might interpret that and make a purchasing decision based on that, and how they then may come back and say, wow, I thought this school was the only one who offered these types of programs because of what their content said, but here I find out that it's actually offered in a number of locations.
Absolutely.
So it's just we're trying to be sensitive and helpful to you.
Thank you so much.
As well.
I will make a note of that.
A couple other areas. Mm-hmm. There's areas like on page 6 where you do identify administrative assistants offering counseling.
We do. That's financial aid counseling.
Okay. There are just some subtleties there. There's always sensitivity around the word counseling.
Yes.
You're kind of tied with health, and so there may be interpretations there of they're providing some type of professional counseling services or something of that nature.
We'll make a change to that. Thank you.
I appreciate that as well. There on page 8, and I don't have a really long list, so I know it can sound like, oh, man. But it's not that bad. But there, on page 8, you have asterisks where it says subject to change, but then there's nowhere actually on the page where you use the asterisks. So it's, I don't know if it's like everything
on the old, or the new?
On the one you provided to us. And it was also reflected in the one you had on the website as well.
On page 8, We do have a subject to change on page 8, which is our academic calendar. Is that what you see?
Right. Yeah, so I'm just more, I guess, more familiar with seeing, like, particular areas then starred where it's just...
No, it's just a general clause where, just in case, for example, if we look at fall 2018, August 6th through November 9th for pharmacy technician, I am hoping to have a class at that time. But if we do not have students enrolled, then I will not be able to have it. So we just want to make sure that if it's not August 6th, it's going to be August 12th.
Right.
So we have that leeway to be able to change the dates.
Appreciate that. It just seems like everything's able to change. So how do you keep up with your catalog to reflect when those changes are made?
The way I keep up with it is the enrollment of students. If I do not have the enrollment of students for a particular class, and I won't be able to have it. For example, if I have one student that wants to participate in the medical coder and biller, but my requirement is to have six or more in that class, and it is scheduled to be May 14th, then I would have to tell that student, unfortunately, I can't hold the class on May 14th. So it's going to change for another date until I have the full enrollment.
I appreciate that. How much change, if you were to look at the last year, how much change have you had where some students sign up, you're moving dates around 90% of the time?
No.
25%
of the time? I'm going to say it's about 40%, actually, because our most popular classes are the medical office specialist, phlebotomy, and the CNA. Those are our most popular classes. As far as the medical coder and biller and the pharmacy technician, they're not as popular. So I am having to change the dates. I have a projected date, and sometimes I cannot meet that because there's no interest in it.
Okay. Certainly things change. We know that piece of it. A couple other things, maybe just bookkeeping.
Mm-hmm.
Page 9, where you have closed for 2 weeks under December,
yes,
25th. I'm assuming that's for kind of
the Christmas and New Year's
holiday.
Since they fall in with
it. But then you also call out New Year's as being a day off as well. So it's maybe just be some opportunity there for your students on that side of it.
To be specific is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I just put the close dates up front too, so it's just very clear.
Okay.
Skip over that. In regards to the enrollment agreement pieces of it, I did have just a couple questions there as well.
Are you done with the catalog?
Yes, if you want to continue asking, by all means.
I do have a catalog. First is a question. You are approved in the Department of Ed for only one of your programs, and under the short term, which require the placement rate, et cetera. You have other programs that have appear to have enough hours. Are you planning to apply for Title IV for them as well?
We are hoping for that, yes. But at this time, it's only the medical office specialist.
Are you waiting for the point where it's been taught for 2 years, or are there other reasons why?
That's correct.
So under on page 36, under academic information, you have financial aid, satisfactory academic progress, and you just say to all qualified programs, but you don't specify what qualified programs are. And somewhere else, you mentioned, I think just once, that you which program qualifies for financial aid, then you're kind of silent everywhere else about it.
I'm sorry, can you say page 36?
36 of the catalog you gave us.
Yes.
So on academic information, mm-hmm. and then financial aid, satisfactory academic progress. It says satisfactory academic progress to all qualified programs, but you don't say what a qualified program is, and a student is not going to go back and find out where you reference that this applies to Title IV. Financial aid, etc. So what is a qualified program? Do you apply it? Some schools apply satisfactory progress to all programs, whether they qualify for financial aid or not. So that's just a very ambiguous comment. I had no idea what you meant. So make it clear whether if you apply satisfactory progress, whether Title IV or not, you would make that statement. If it's only applicable to students who have Title IV, then you would make that statement. But you can't just make to all qualified programs and leave people to guess what you mean.
In the new catalog, and it's also, I think, on page 36, it does say that it applies to standard satisfactory academic progress to all qualified programs, and it lists the three programs.
Perfect. So your new catalog is better than your old. Good job.
Yes.
Page 40, under attendance,
mm-hmm.
academic information, you have conflicting information here. You say students who are absent for two consecutive days, excluding the holidays, will be automatically terminated from the program. That is a definitive statement. Okay. And then later, you say that you do allow students to make up absence that occurred during lecture.
Mm-hmm.
It
kind of contradicts it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, so you can just say that students may be automatically terminated and then give that qualifying statement of what it would be, just so that we know what that means.
Change the word will to may.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good.
You already answered that question.
That flows, that last one flows over to the enrollment agreement as well. So there's some opportunity there.
And then one last one on page 46. Under financial aid policy, again, you're not specifying which programs are Title IV eligible, but you also talk about a combination of loans, grants, family contribution, and other sources of aid, and you don't qualify for it. That's probably like a standard bullet that was used, but because you have a short-term program, and short-term programs are not eligible for grants, so you'll need to either take out that grant or describe what grant it is you're offering. Because there is no grant referenced, and it's certainly not a federal grant.
Is it in the paragraph where it says combination of loans, grant, family contribution? Is that the one?
Yeah, it's the very first statement.
Yes.
So students may then contact you saying, I want a grant.
And we do provide grants. Regional Center for Border Health does offer those opportunities for
it's
grants.
Not listed on this page.
So is that what you want me to be specific in regards to Regional Center for Border Health grants?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, because you say that general statement about financial aid, and then all the financial aid that you're talking about here, you talk about the loans, the federal loans, and then mm-hmm. you talk about federal loan repayment.
Yes.
And then the federal aid website, there's no mention of anything else except Title IV.
Mm-hmm.
So it would imply that is a Title IV grant.
Ms. Leonard, if she puts regional center grant, that wouldn't be appropriate in that section, would it?
It depends on how she words it, because she doesn't say federal financial aid. She just says financial aid
but
policy.
But isn't that a Title IV policy that right there?
She's not wording it saying federal, so it's all in the words. So you can have financial aid that applies to institutional
anything.
Aid,
mm-hmm.
gotcha.
Aid, et cetera. It's all in the wording. And so she did in that first paragraph, she does not reference federal, but then everything description below is all about federal, which then made me think that did apply to things. To federal,
yes.
even though you didn't say it.
Just I got it. Oh, I get it.
Okay. So probably when you read it, you assumed it because it then all talked about federal aid, but the actual intro paragraph
doesn't say no, it doesn't.
Okay,
so
I get it.
All financial aid, then specify what it is, and then add the non-federal aid. And you could even put it in categories, like federal aid applies to this program, and then the other aid, and say if it's all programs or just which programs it goes for.
Well, currently, because of the date of the... for financial aid for the medical office specialist, is it appropriate just to leave it as is since we only have it for the medical office specialist? And
that,
it opens
so that grant
it up.
Is only for eligible for the same program as the federal aid?
This grant is open for all programs.
Okay. Then you either have one section that says Title IV federal aid and say what program it is, and then have a separate one that says the grant is for all. You just have to spell it out very clearly because as written, if I were a student, I would think at any of your programs, I can get grants and loans. And I can't get either. And in fact, nobody can get grants, federal grants.
Right. Okay.
So it's all about clarity. You want to avoid having a case brought against you to the complaint committee.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the students feel that you have misrepresented. And then since you do have this currently one program in federal aid, they are very, very big on misrepresentation. So if you do or say anything that leads a student to believe they're eligible for something they're not, that is like a big sin.
Yes, we do. Thank you.
That was all I had.
Kind of rolling to the enrollment agreement, there were only two areas I just maybe wanted to call out. When you talk about the refunds and the calculation piece, and more importantly, the repayment piece, you call out from 30 days, within 30 days, but you don't call out from when. So whether that's the date of determination or last day of attendance, you use last day of attendance, and maybe because of the two-day
kind of you're removed from the class after 2 days of missing. You're well within that, but there may be some opportunity to just provide some clarity. So, again, as Madam Chair had mentioned, it's not misinterpreted that they're taking it from 30 days from the last day of attendance when you may have found out several days later or something to that degree.
In our catalog, and thank you, in our catalog, there is a section where it describes, depending on the academic probation, if the student is continuously not meeting the requirements, there is a guideline where, for example, the medical office specialist after the fourth week. And so that's where we have to make sure that the student is paid up to that time. So we give them the opportunity to have a payment plan.
Yeah, this is more your refund to the students. So this is where essentially what you're saying, it reads, the tuition charges and refunds for the enrollment period will be returned within 30 days. So 30 days from last day of attendance.
The last day of attendance. Okay.
Okay, so you may just want to look at that. It's a tight policy, but I would just encourage you to look at that piece so it's clear to, the students of when they would expect that.
In
due by date of determination, that when you actually determine they were no longer attending school.
If I might interject, in our catalog, it does state that the institution should provide 100% refund of all tuitions and fees for the student no later than 30 days of receiving the notice. So what I can do is I can take this paragraph and substitute it to that in order for it to comply.
So I think you're making a very good statement there of showing how what happens if a student just leaves the program and you actually never get notification.
Well, the notification would be if the student just leaves without notice, then the notice is the date we have on the form where the student abandoned the class. That's the 30 days from that notice.
So I think there's probably opportunity to just provide clarity there.
On the enrollment.
Because I'll help you with that.
Perfect.
Thank you.
What comes down to is one is the days that you use to calculate the refund, and one is when the clock starts to make the refund, and it has to be very, very clear. So she'll work you on it.
Thank you so much.
Needs to be.
Thank you.
And then the only other area that I think has some pretty good opportunity on the enrollment agreement is your section 9 or number 9 item, where it just says the student also understands that the decision of the instructor is final and there is no situation where decisions can be appealed. And there's nothing that sets up, I think that was interpreted to be in a classroom setting of like a grade, but how it's stated, because it's not really under any type of subsection to set it up, it sounds like there is no appeal. The instructor is the final decision maker on everything. They want to terminate you, you have no appeal. You have an issue against, a claim against your instructor, there is no appeal. The final decision maker is the instructor, and I think that would be out of alignment.
They agree with.
No, that's
And we do have an appeal process, and it is stated in our catalog. So what I'll do is
it's just conflicting information.
Yes.
It does go on later to talk about makeup time and those types of things, but unfortunately, the way the statement is set up,
yes,
it would be easy to interpret it as the instructor does make all final decisions for the institution.
And it is not the instructor, actually, it's the campus administrator that does the
audit. Which is reflected in the catalog, unfortunately not reflected in the enrollment agreement. So the student would just walk away with what's in the enrollment agreement, and that is not reflective of what we would expect for an appeals process.
Absolutely, I will make those changes. Thank you.
That's really all I had from that standpoint.
I have a couple more on the enrollment agreement. One thing that he's mentioned a couple times there was that your catalog said one thing and the enrollment agreement said something else. So your enrollment agreement is your legal contract with the student, and the catalog is backing it up. So it's imperative that your language be the same between the two. And sometimes to save words, people will put shorter statements on the enrollment agreement, but they have to be materially the same. Mm-hmm. So like one of my comments is under admissions requirements, if you have high school diploma or GED, but in your catalog, you talk about some equivalent and you talk about homeschooling, et cetera. And so you want to have the wording be exactly the same so that if the person says, I was homeschooled or whatever the case may be of why they would come in, I have an associate's degree or whatever,
And then they sign an enrollment agreement that's saying they met high school diploma or GED. Well, your enrollment agreement doesn't allow for them to sign it saying everything is true. If they don't actually have a high school diploma or GED, you may have an associate's instead. So if you're, just make sure your language is the same. And schools genuinely put high school diploma or equivalent, and then they either do or don't could explain what equivalent might be. Mm-hmm. And a good place to look is if you go to the Department of Ed on IFAP, what they have for equivalent will just serve you well, because if you have similar language to what you have, that the department has, as your programs expand and as you become eligible, you're not worried about having different qualifications, whether you're Title IV eligible or not Title IV eligible, unless you want that. You may have, you know, a shorter program that has a lesser standard, and that's fine. And then also on your refunds, it looked to me like you were silent about the books, uniforms, supplies, equipment, AAPC membership, certification exams. You don't say what happens on those, and you have to specify if they are non-refundable, if they are subject to the proration. If they're non-refundable to a certain point, like the certification exams, if they drop out in the first week, are you really charging them for that exam?
No, we reimburse them for the exam.
You don't say that. So, again, you want to avoid coming for the complaint committee. You want to avoid the students not having understanding of what they're signing. So if anything is non-refundable, like let's say on the books, if once they get the book, that particular book they can't give back, books that are unissued or returned in unopened condition, whatever, are refundable, all else or not. Whatever the case is, just specify it. Mm-hmm. And that's the same on all of them. Like some of your EAs have like uniforms and others don't, et cetera. So they may have different costs, but whatever all the costs are, you have to explain it. And then make sure it's consistent in your catalog, your EA, and your website. And so since you're redoing the catalog right now, this timing is good, so you can get
those.
Yes, it
is. Thank you. Done. Yes. I am making those notes. Thank you very much.
That's all I have.
A quick question. Amanda Aguirre.
Aguirre.
The president of the school or the health center?
Regional Center for Border Health is the nonprofit that owns the College of Health Careers, and Amanda Aguirre is the president and CEO of all of its subsidiaries, which are the College of Health Careers, the Main Street Cafe, the San Luis Walking Clinic, San Luis Diagnostic Center, San Luis Urgent Care, the Center for Children with Autism and Special Needs. And so those are just some of the subsidiaries that Regional Center for Border Health owns. And yes, Amanda Aguirre does oversee all of them as its president and CEO.
So she oversees the school, but I believe the day-to-day operations of running is Ms. Zendejas?
Correct.
Okay.
I'd like to make a motion then that we approve the license renewal for Regional Center of Border Health, College of Health Careers, conditional on the surety bond, also providing electronic copies of the student records on a monthly basis. I'd also like to include that they return in August with the update from ABHES as well. That'd be my motion.
All right, a motion. Do we have a second?
Clarification on the amount of the surety bond. Currently they have 15. Are you suggesting that it be increased based upon the calculation?
I am. Okay. I'd like to amend that motion to be consistent with our calculation.
Just so you know, the increase, the surety bond currently is 15, and due to the so on and so forth, the board is requesting it to be increased to, and it's based upon a surety bond calculation, so it'll come to $63,234.
Nice. So we have an amended motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. Motion and second. Do you agree to those conditions?
I do have a question in regards to the, if I can get a clarification on the monthly reporting of. You wanted something monthly?
Of the student records.
Thank you.
But it's basically the enrollment agreement, the transcripts, and we'll have to start.
And you can work with Mr. LaMountain on that. He'll
thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much.
So do you agree to the stipulation?
Yes, we do. Thank you.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Can I have a roll call vote? Yes, excuse me.
Mike Romano, aye.
Craig Jacob, aye.
Mr. Sonnet, aye.
Gee, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Vans Wool, aye.
All right. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Much. Thank you so much.
And you'll send me that time. Catalog as soon as it's finalized.
Absolutely.
What you might do is send the catalog and the enrollment agreement and highlight all the changes.
Okay.
Really easy to follow.
Okay. Would you like a copy of the draft now? Or
no, no, because you got changes to make now.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much.
You don't want me reading it to her every time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
So it's 12:30.
One last.
Okay, just pushing on through. Let's do it back. We'll just take a 5-minute break, and then.
I don't want a 5-minute break.
So at 12:30, we're taking. We are back in session.
I believe you.
I'm like sitting on my hands.
The next order of business is the supplemental license application for a change of ownership for Ancora Education, purchase of Delta Career Education Corporation, shared services center in Tampa.
Oh, there it is.
Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. January 18th of this year, SBT AAIA Education doing business as Ancora Education purchased a select number of institutions from Delta Career Education Corporation. One of the institutions purchased include the DCEC Shared Services Center in Tempe, Arizona. They do provide services for three of the institutions, Miller Mott College, with two locations in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Conway, South Carolina, and the McCann School of Business and Technology in Louisiana. These institutions are, I believe, now under the main campus of Platt College in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The prior, DCEC has been licensed to the board since 2011. As a service center, the board will not be responsible for any of the students of the three institutions they provide services for, nor do we review or approve the programs offered by the institution, as that is the responsibility of the home state. Obviously, because they have a physical location, licensure is required. Ancora also owns Arizona Automotive Institute, and they purchased them in 2013. And your board member lead is Mr. Lukey, and here representing the institution is Dr. Donna Payne and Joe Pilar, CFO, and Dr. Thomas Wade.
Yes, Dr. Wade is our chief academic officer.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Yourselves for the record, just in case she mispronounced her name.
Dr. Thomas Waite, Chief Academic Officer.
Dr. Donna Payne, Senior Manager for Online Licensure and Accreditation. And Joe, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, Joseph Eiler, CFO.
Very good. Do you have an opening remark?
Well, I did, but Executive Director Stanfield did such a great job. And so, no, I would just give a little bit, a few more statistics. As a result of the acquisition of some of the, of certain assets of Delta Career Education Corporation, STVT AI now serves 9,795 students in 9 states and across 26 campuses. Of those almost 9,800 students, as of Monday, 1,284 of those students were fully online students who were being provided services through the Shared Services Center located in Tempe. The Shared Services Center provides services to students in the areas of admissions, financial aid, faculty management, and student services. And as Executive Director Stanfield said, it's been a license since 2011. We do not anticipate any significant changes, in the operations of the center as a result of the acquisition. So we're open to answer any of your questions.
Very good. Thank you. Appreciate the background information on it. So you really don't teach any students in the state of Arizona, but you may actually recruit students from the state. Is that correct?
The institutions, as of about as of March the 8th, I believe, are now licensed or approved through NCSERA. So there could be a possibility that we would have Arizona students, but currently we are not actively marketing in Arizona.
NCSERA doesn't actually license.
Mm-hmm. They approve.
Yeah, but like if you were saying that, you know, they go through a lot of trouble to say that they are not a licensed.
Right. They approve.
Yeah.
They approve institutions to participate in the reciprocity agreements.
Perfect.
Prior to acquiring the Delta schools, you already were providing shared services for other institutions or other schools. Is that correct?
The Shared Services Center was the Delta Career Education Shared Services Center. As part of the acquisition, Ancora acquired the Shared Services Center located in Tempe.
Okay. Which services three schools, one in North Carolina, one in South Carolina, and one in
Monroe, Louisiana. Yes, sir.
All right, very good. All right, so no changes. Now, your balance sheet shows that there was a net loss of 1.8 million.
This is Joe Filer, and interject. And on the reporting that's done as part of number 11 and 12, it shows a $1.8 million profit, which is just the correct number. Embarrassingly, on my part, the supplemental financial statement we provided has the right numbers, but the wrong tag on it. It says net loss, but if you look at the numbers, it is a net profit.
Huh. Okay, that's kind of a nice mistake.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a good thing it wasn't the other way around. All right, very good. That's an easy fix. Get you comfortable with that over there?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm mumbling.
Are you comfortable?
Yes.
Okay. This is such a straightforward application. I really don't have any other questions. I assume all student complaints in these respective schools go directly to their home states.
Yes, they do.
Okay. So it's really just our involvement with you is really strictly a technicality. Is that correct?
Because they have a physical presence, yes.
It's because they have physical presence. Okay. Well, welcome to Arizona.
Thank you.
Hello. We've crossed paths in the past.
Some always.
We'd prefer not to talk about that one.
One of the perks is to be able to come before us once a year and get renewed. So, some other members have questions.
I didn't either.
Wow.
I want to know how many of you read all 2,500 pages.
Yes, he probably did.
Yeah, just about.
I'm so sorry.
You did last time.
Yeah.
That was 3,000.
That
got worn out.
It only takes this file forever to download.
I would like to make a motion then that we grant a supplemental license application for a change of ownership. And one little caveat, will you be submitting an application for a change of name?
Yes, I think it's already submitted.
It's in the works, so we'll see that maybe on the next agenda.
We discussed it.
Okay. There will also be a change of location application coming through in the next few weeks. Just
slow down.
Okay, so that's my motion
away.
Is to grant a supplemental license.
Motion grant second.
Second, Craig Jacob.
And motion second. All right. We have no stipulations. Any further discussion? All right. Roll call vote.
Mike Romano, aye. Craig Jacob, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Bill Vanswill, aye.
All right. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. You all have a blessed afternoon.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Danto.
Call to the public. Fran.
Ms. Danto, board business?
Yes.
I have a I forgot a copy.
Madam Chair, members of the board, thank you all for your work. I'm still kind of horsey and current. Don't have much of a voice. Conference was last week, and it was a good time. We had a great conference. So those of you attended, you know. Those of you that didn't, you missed a good one, but we'll see you all next year. I'll be sure to invite you. Thank you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Fred.
It was a wonderful conference. Thank you.
It was very good.
The board business, Minister?
The only, I would tell you that I did add under other regulatory accrediting agency actions, the actions that ASSET and then ACICS has taken against Virginia Colleges, who does own the Golf Academy here, and they have appealed both of them. So who knows what'll happen with that. ACICS did something to poor UEI. Sorry.
Career Services placement. I mean, CNTU placement.
Okay. So, other than that, it's I don't have anything else to add except Kevin can give you an update on the fact that we went live on Monday on the e-licensing.
Yes, we did submit, and thanks to Scott for very handling walking us through the so we went live on Monday. We sent out the communication to all the schools on that Monday. A substantial number of inquiries into how to use it. Our training plan put together will start in June. For those that are going to be over the renewal cycle, that's going to really be our first test of inaccurate. And then we'll start that training in June and July. So we should be all good for that. We hired Deloitte to stay on for another 4 weeks.
Yes, we had to pay support. More money.
But it was it's certainly worth it. It's worth the money that we're paying to keep them on so that the fixes as we find them. I found one Scott with them. Not known to us, or it's going to be paying us some time to fix it.
But you could pay us the additional $1,500. We'll take that. It did. It submitted like four apps. It charged them $500 per app.
I mean, the money is.
We'll take the money. We need it.
We're up and running.
And I got my thing, but I have not yet gone on. So I think it's not going to get felt to. So we'll get our sign-ons, passwords, and then that's how we will get our board materials henceforth.
You can monitor the board material. You can look at it and download it. I still think that just based on what we're doing now,
it'll still probably be this way for a while.
We can go and have it sent out to you.
One thing at a time.
Okay.
I can only do one change at a time.
I know what to expect from there.
And Terry, our... Terry is almost all 100% paperless now.
So he's so excited. From one box to this.
One more visit by Mr. Blanchard.
Oh.
So what? Carrying those big boxes.
A question is, when the first electronic application comes in for a school, will all the previous stuff just go to storage or be destroyed, or will it
The last 2 years, we have scanned and are in our cloud. All the others are the paper over at Iron Mountain.
How long do you have to, are you required to keep all of them?
Oh, I gotta change this. We amended the retention schedule and I haven't done it yet. Currently right now is 30 and we changed it to 11. Think.
And then will you go through as your next like little project to clear out Iron Mountain to reduce the...
Well, one of our little projects was document digitizing, which was to take care of all of the documents that we have over at Iron Mountain.
That project stalled out, what, 4 months ago?
No, I mean, that if you only have to keep 11, so then 12 to 30 years, can you get rid of all of those?
The student retention schedule is forever.
Yeah.
It's the board document that you see now, the institution document. We'll have to purge what we have in there, but we have 2 years plus now all of it that we've recorded. Board documents to
just you mentioned money, I would imagine if you can, you know, clear out whole sections that iron out now, just keep reducing it.
We'd have to incur money to pay someone to go over there and sort through it. Well,
it's not organized by year.
So your guess is what?
I have a spreadsheet and I'm going to activate and look at the attention to update every single item on our almost 10,000 boxes to make sure we know the contents. And most of them are organized by student members, teachers, and we had a document most updated. It's not consistent. I can identify which ones we do have cataloged to reduce those.
I have to get the schedules revised and approved by the Secretary of State first.
I just did a project one time that it turned out that things had been pulled back and there were entire sections that were empty and we were paying rent for them and that, you know, and they'd been destroyed and we had them documented as destroyed, but that when we actually physically went there, we found there were whole sections we were just paying for empty space and everything in the section was water and they wanted to block through. And so it was worth sending a staff member there to find out and we just saved a bunch of money.
Well, all the boxes did just recently transfer from the state over to Iron Mountain.
Okay, that's
everything. So I would doubt that would be the case, but it is something that needs to be done in the future. Hopefully.
Oh, yeah, you have to get this project done.
Yeah.
Just lining you up for the next project.
Yes.
All right. Anything else? All right. In that case, we adjourn at 12:51. Oh, no.
What?
So this is more of an update. No real board action is necessary, but it can be done in executive session. Up to the board if they would like to give us legal advice.
Oh.
Okay. So we need to request to go into executive session at 12:52.
Okay. Just hang up the phone.
Everything's ending.
Oh. All right, when? I'm going to go. All right, we're back in session at 12:58. If our legal counsel would be so.
Board will release public records as required by law. However, when it comes to financial assistance, the board will ask to execute the resolution that is passed out for evaluating whether or not the
All right, thank you for that update. Anything else? All right, we officially end the meeting at 12:59. I know. So I'm probably just going to go upstairs and join Terry to our.
Good to see you too.
Enjoy.
Yep.
Have a safe trip back.
Yeah, thank you.
See you.
Long way to go first.
Little piece of it. It's all a desert.
We're down there Saturday, moving my son out of his house.
Are you? Oh, man.
He's got a job.
You don't normally move into a house?
Get out.
Is this coming home?
No, he got a job. Going to Tennessee this week.
Oh, wow.
You're driving to Tennessee?
What's that?
You're driving to Tennessee?
My wife.
Oh, your wife? You're not driving?
I didn't.
Collect a microphone.
So. Mm-hmm. Unless you want to take it home.
No, I had no idea.
Actually, the objective of
night. It wasn't built, you know.
Bye.
Talk to you
later. Oh my God, I never did.
All right, I'm good.
I'm having a problem.